picture. My husband didn't want me to go, but he knew that I had accepted this $5,800. It was enough for us to buy a secondhand car and to buy some things like a piano and a mirror and a rug and a television, our first television. I had enough money to do that. And I went up to New Haven alone. My sister came and took my three children to my mother.
You were pregnant, though.
But I was pregnant. My husband was very upset, but he didn't have any money. And he went back. We were in North Carolina. So he went home to High Point and stayed with his people, while I went to school. I had, this is an interesting sideline, when I realized I was pregnant and had this money and planned to go to Yale, I would get up on tables and jump off trying to have an abortion.
Oh, bless your heart.
I swore I couldn't go up to this male university.
Pregnant.
Pregnant.
Yeah. We already knew how hard it was for a woman, a white woman, to get through.
That's right.
Let alone
how in the world could I go up there pregnant? Black woman pregnant. I tried to convince the doctors and the nurses and the social workers that I was crazy and needed a therapeutic abortion. My husband says, she may be crazy, I don't deny that, but she's going to have that baby. And I knew I couldn't have an abortion if he said no. And he said no. He said, I'm not going to risk the life of the mother of three to keep her from having the fourth. Mm. He said, now I know, maybe we got enough. We can't afford this. But I told her when we married, I didn't want a lot of snotty-nosed babies. But here she is now. She's pregnant. That's my baby, too. I have some say-so. She is not going to have an abortion. And I didn't.
You had the baby?
I had the baby, but...
Which was born when?
The following June.
June of 55.
54.
Well, you were up at Yale all that time.
I was at Yale from January till May. I came home, came back on the 10th of May.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as bad as you would think it would be. I was a very small person. I wore a maternity garment, corset. But more than that, I had a cousin who had worked on Madison Avenue as a modiste, a seamstress. She made me a wardrobe of maternity clothes. And she spared no expense. The finest of materials. I had a tent coat that was navy blue flannel. It wasn't serge, it was flannel. With buttons here. It looked like nothing but a cape. It looked like a cape, but it was a coat.
Mm-hmm.
Very full, which meant you, I don't know how big you got, you weren't going to look bad in that coat.
Mm-hmm.
Then she made me a tweed suit that allowed the skirt to give as my body grew, and a double-breasted coat, and it was very good looking. Then she made me a silk print dress that allowed the blouse. It was some of the newest things, and she made a jumper with a blouse. People in the streets, black and white, would turn around and say, girl, you look good.
You dressed, man.
Girl, you look good. Not a day did I go over there to Yale that I was embarrassed because I looked very, very nice.
Yeah.
And I had bought very sensible shoes that cost a lot of money but that held my feet to the ground and I could wear it through the snow.
All right.
So
now,
that's
how you got through that. Now, this is a good place for me to stop because I need to go back and pick up a couple of things.
Jubilee hasn't come off yet.
All right, that's not there yet, but we're leaving out a couple of things. Mm-hmm. One is the Rosenwald Fellowship. You got in 44.
That's right.
And that was for a year.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that experience. How did you get it?
I had the first baby on that thing.
Did you?
Langston Hughes and Arnold laughed and said, your first baby ought to be named Rosenwald and your last baby ought to be named Ford. That I had babies on fellowships. Well, one thing that was good about it, when I took the only school I ever took maternity leave from was Livingstone. I left there in March. Baby was born in May. And I didn't go back. My husband had said, I wish you'd stay. I wish you wouldn't work with these children for 2 years. I wish you'd give this baby. You'd stay home 2 years. I stayed home with that baby 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
By that time, I was having another baby.
Yeah.
But there's a great difference in black women and white women, working women, working mothers, and women with abortions.
Mm-hmm.
My husband would not allow me to have an abortion, and I'm not sorry.
Yeah.
We managed to get through it. I didn't want an abortion, but I hated to go to that male school pregnant.
Yeah, sure.
To me, it was an embarrassment. I never let it embarrass me a day. I went up there. And when I went back to Jackson, the president of the school was so mad that I came back with a baby. He wanted to know, when did I have time to have a baby? I had done all this research. I had been up to Yale and had these four courses.
Mm.
I had studied television and architecture and American studies.
Mm. Amazing.
And then here I was with a beautiful little girl.
What did you do on that Rosenwald year?
That Rosenwald year was the first year that, well, that was, I tell you, I had a baby.
Yeah, and so did you just stay at home and work?
No.
I didn't think so.
No, I wrote a great deal, and I worked on the research. I went up to the Schomburg Collection in New York. I went in Chicago. Which one of the libraries? I went to Newberry, I think. And I think I went to Crerar. I was in Chicago, I was in New York, and what else did I do?
Did you write This Is My Country during that time? When did you write that book?
That's not my book.
That's not your book?
This Is My Century.
This Is My Century. Okay, I got the name wrong.
Yeah, that book consists of five small volumes of poetry.
I see.
For My People had been published in 42. And the next book of poetry didn't come out until 1970.
Oh, I see.
In the period that I was having these babies, I was rarely publishing anything.
I see.
1955, after I had come back from Yale, that year I published only one thing. That was a poem in the Virginia Quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
Dear are the names that charm me in my youth. When the Rosenwald thing came out, I published in Common Ground, and I had been up to Yaddo. I wrote at Yaddo. Yaddo, this place reminds me a lot of Yaddo. And at Yaddo, I wrote a ballad called Harriet Tubman. And I also worked on, I did a little on Jubilee, because I couldn't do anything at Yaddo. There was no place for me to do any research. But I wrote the article, Growing Out of Shadow, for Common Ground. And I sold that to them. They bought that. That was what I did on the Rosenwald.
Yeah.
And then I didn't go back to teach that fall.
Mm-hmm.
My husband was overseas, flat off his back in Wales with a broken vertebra in his back.
This was in the war years.
World War II, yeah. In 44, when my first child was born. And I had just gotten, well, I had had the money from the Rosenwald from the year before,
right.
43, 44.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, my money was running out.
Mm-hmm.
When the baby was born, I didn't have to pay a lot of money at the hospital because I was a soldier's wife. I think I got that baby for $82.
Wow.
That's something. Man. Think about thousands of dollars now.
I'd like to ask you some more philosophical questions.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think your vision of the ultimate goal of Black Americans has changed significantly, say, from the 1930s when you were in Chicago to the 1950s when you were in Mississippi?
I think it would be better to say it has changed now in this decade of the 90s.
Yeah, but
if you
back
go back
then,
there, then it hadn't changed. I think when I left Chicago to go to Iowa and came south, I had a very radical vision of change in America for Black people. I really believed that the democratic process was going to take place, that Black people, through struggle, could change our destiny. When Martin Luther King came along in the 50s, I held there was a lump in our throats. We held our breath. We really thought we were on our way. When he got the Nobel Prize
mm-hmm.
in Oslo, even when he was assassinated and the holiday was declared, I'm not the holiday, the half mask
mm-hmm.
and the funeral stuff, we believed we were making progress.
Mm-hmm.
The 1965 Voting Rights Act was progress.
Yeah.
I have seen what that has done in the South, in
Mississippi. There's no denying that. There's no denying that.
It has
absolutely worked. Made progress.
It's made progress
around that one issue.
That's
for
right.
Certain.
That's right. Now, the problems of poverty. Now, I want to say something I was about to forget. In the 1930s, in Chicago, and I was there most of that decade, I saw what Roosevelt's Bloodless Revolution did for Black people. I saw the difference it made from the time before Roosevelt was elected, when I saw drunken men on the streets of Chicago and men sleeping under newspapers in Grant Park, and saw soup bread lines and soup kitchens, which was different from Hoover's men standing on the corner with a box of apples.
Right.
You'd see one apple out of the box and nobody bought those apples.
Right.
But I never, in the whole decade of the 30s, in Chicago nor anywhere else, saw whole families with their possessions on a cart, homeless in the streets. Not a day did I see that in the 30s. People were on relief, yes. People didn't have jobs, yes. They had relief, home relief. They were in houses. They were in projects. They were indoors. Their housing was not the best, but it was nothing like homeless people on the streets today.
So you were a believer in the Roosevelt Revolution.
I believed in Roosevelt the way the 60s young people believed in Kennedy.
All right, now, the first part of that Roosevelt Revolution, from 32 through the first administration till 36, there wasn't a lot said about race. And after 36, when he got into the second administration, then a bunch of things began to come up, and the whole Southern white politicians structure turned against Roosevelt.
I don't recall it happening in the 30s at all. I tell you what I recall. We went to war in 1941. And that is when the big issue of race and segregation pushed up its head again. In 1941, the NAACP said, we are segregated at home, we are segregated abroad. We are segregated in the Army, the Navy, the Marines, and the Air Force. When is America going to stop segregation? It was World War II when Roosevelt issued 8842.
That's right. The jobs. The fair employment.
The fair employment is not the same as you 8842.
FEPC.
FEPC was fair employment. 8842 was no segregation in the Army.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Cut out segregation in the Army.
Yeah.
You've got to treat these men the same way. That was just an order because they didn't do it.
Yeah, right. It didn't happen until Truman finally
made
it happen.
And then Truman came up with it again. And Truman said, the thing has gotten so bad under Truman. The big race issue was, we have to have a commission on race.
Yeah, right. That was in 46, I think.
That's when Truman said that. But Roosevelt, 1932 to 1936, was, as you say, a period of trying all the way to 38.
Mm-hmm.
A period of rebuilding the economy in this country, putting people to work.
Relief and recovery.
And you know one thing I remember? My mother and father and I, all three of us worked on WPA. They worked on WPA in New Orleans, on adult education programs. But we lost our house. And when they told my mother that the house was gone, they told her the homeowners loan organization out of Memphis said that the house was foreclosed. My mother sat down and wrote a letter to President Roosevelt. She had the nerve. She said, President and Mrs. Roosevelt. And she told about my father and that she was the daughter of a Baptist minister and her husband was the minister. And didn't have any jobs and didn't have any money and had been trying. And they had this house. And the house didn't cost but about $1,800, I think. And they had been paying the notes, and now they had gotten behind, they had no work. And the homeowners loan company out of Memphis informed them that their house was foreclosed. Do you know we got our house back?
How did it happen?
Homeowners loan people told us that the...
Did you hear from Roosevelt?
No.
You just came through the homeowners...
Through Memphis.
Yeah. Somebody passed the word down there.
It went there.
Well, you ended up being a real strong believer in Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt.
Mrs. more than...
Yeah.
I met and talked and knew Mrs. Roosevelt.
Was she as true blue as most people say?
She was wonderful.
Yeah.
I had been told as a little girl growing up there and hearing about her. And she was such an ugly woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she had this... Everybody said, oh, that's an ugly woman, and she sounds worse than she looks. You know, that was the southern feeling. When I saw her, I said, well, there's nothing ugly about this woman. She was so beautiful, so absolutely gracious. She stood and talked to me as much as Mrs. Bethune did.
Yeah.
She came with Mrs. Bethune to Livingstone College.
Uh-huh. That's when you met
her. That's when I met her. And I cast my first vote in this life, in this country, in Chicago in 1936 for Roosevelt.
Yeah.
I believe that...
All right, now. Let me
yes, I believe in Roosevelt. You couldn't tell me that the country wasn't on the right road because I had seen 4 years of Hoover.
Yeah.
You couldn't tell me when I had seen men laid off and looked, and the automobile shops were running and the steel mills were running. You understand?
Yeah.
And the trains were running.
All right, now let me play the devil's advocate just for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
You're back home in the South,
mm-hmm.
and the South isn't doing the darn thing. It's not changing. It's still full of Jim Crow segregation from one end to the other.
It wasn't any different from what it was when I left it.
It's just exactly the same.
Same way I left it.
All right, and then and 32, then 36, then 1940. Roosevelt been elected three times. And still that stuff wasn't changing.
Well,
did you ever come around to feel...
The propaganda was that it was changing.
Uh-huh.
The times, they are changing.
And did you kind of believe that?
Not too much. I wasn't too enthusiastic about it. But I had lived through the 30s in Chicago. And New Orleans looked like a clean avenue to me to what I had seen in Chicago.
Did Jackson also?
Well, when I went to Jackson in 49, I made up my mind. In fact, I went down there to speak in 43. And when I spoke there, I decided this is a nice little town.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke at a college, in a college auditorium, and the choir was absolutely beautiful, and the audience was full of very well-dressed black people, and the students were intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
People took me out to dinner afterwards, and I knew I was in the South, and I knew I was in Mississippi, and I was impressed. I'll be honest with you, I was impressed. And in 1949, when I was sitting at home, baby less than 6 weeks old, baby born in July, and this is August, close to September, it must have been close to September, the baby was born the 26th of July, so the 26th of August, he was just 4 weeks old, or a month old. And my brother had just finished college, Southern. And he was looking for a job to teach mathematics. And a woman we knew named Miss Castor told him to call Jackson College and ask to speak to Dean Sampson and see if he didn't have a job in mathematics for him. And he called. And the dean said, "Well, do you have a master's?" He said, "No, I just finished college. I have a bachelor's." He said, "Well, we have a man with a bachelor's in mathematics. We need a man with a higher degree. Now, we will take anybody in English. He said, "We need an English teacher so bad. We'll take anybody in English." My brother turned, he said, "You haven't got a job for me, but there's a job for you." He said, "'Cause you can't go anywhere. You just had a baby." My mother said, "I don't see why she can't go." I went when she was 6 weeks old.
Mm-hmm.
She said, "I started teaching when she was 6 weeks old. And she's got three children and she needs to break." My father said, "Oh, she can't work and with the baby like that." Mama said, I think she better try. So I sat down and wrote Dean Sampson a letter. I told him that I understood there was a vacancy in the English department and I was available for the position.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a graduate of Northwestern University with a bachelor's, University of Iowa with a master's. I have spent 5 years on the lecture platform.
Mm-hmm.
I have altogether 7 or 8 years of teaching experience. And I didn't tell him I was the author of a book or anything. I told him I'd be willing to come for an interview at my own expense. And thank you for your immediate consideration. My mother said,
Well, I guess next week you'll get an answer. I said, and next week my foot, that man needs people so bad, he'll send me a telegram. He did. Hmm. He said, if you are who you say you are,
I need you now.
I'm prepared to stay.
Yeah.
I didn't stay, but I went and had the interview, and the president said, you're an answer to prayer. People don't want to teach English in Mississippi. He said, you had a man who had promised us faithfully. He was coming from Chicago. He called and said he couldn't come.
Mm-hmm.
He had a job in Chicago. He couldn't come.
Mm-hmm.
He said, do you accept the teaching in Chicago, in Mississippi? I laughed. I said, accept the teaching in Mississippi? Why should I?
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, most people don't want to. I said, I was born 250 miles from Jackson. I grew up 200 miles from Jackson. I went to school my first day in Mississippi, 90 miles from Jackson. Why should I object to working in Jackson? I'm home.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah, I do. I do. You're very persuasive about what that meant to you.
And teaching in Jackson, Mississippi, I think I'll talk about that tomorrow when I read.
Mm-hmm.
I'm as satisfied and successful working in Mississippi and living there as I would be anywhere else in the world.
Still feel that way.
I know that.
Yeah. Okay, let me take you back one more time, and let's talk about Richard Wright, who was also from Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. And different background.
Yeah, very different. But you met him in Chicago, and mm-hmm. for a period of years there, you were very close.
Mm-hmm. 3 years we knew each other, 3.5 years.
Yeah.
And people wanted to say that I expected him to marry me. It would have been a mistake if he had.
Yeah.
The worst mistake would have been on my part. Not on his.
Mm-hmm. Why do you say that?
Wright literally was so mixed up, so horribly scarred with the psychic wounds of racism, with anger, with ambivalence and alienation. He couldn't make any woman a good husband.
Do you think you were in love with him?
I might have been.
But cemetery, though.
No, it doesn't make any difference. My husband says I couldn't have been. He said, you didn't know what it was like. How could you be in love with a man you never kissed? And
mm-hmm.
other people, some black women say, oh, yes, you loved him all right. Maybe he loved you. But it wasn't a physical attraction.
Yeah.
It was more a marriage of mine.
Uh-huh.
Both of you creative writers, both of you poets, you 20 and he's 27.
Yeah.
That was an attraction
sure.
there.
It had to be.
And
but here's what I don't understand, Ms. Walker. You were from Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't scarred by all that
yes,
stuff.
All of us are scarred.
Well, okay, I take it back.
All of us, every person who lives in the South and who has lived here up till 1954 and 1965,
right.
and unless you were born since then, those
yeah.
little children of mine, that little baby there, 3 years old, he's not scarred yet.
Yeah. See, okay, I misspoke. I understand what you're saying.
All of us are scarred
yeah,
by a psychic wound
right.
of racism.
But you're
and
telling me, though.
This country is just rife with
right.
it.
But you're telling me, though, that here was this great creative genius whose life was practically ruined by those scars, and you're also telling me that
it didn't
that
have to be the way it was with him.
Because it wasn't that way with you. Because
no difference
in now
me.
I want to know, what is the difference?
I'm a believer.
Go on.
I'm a believer. I not only believe in God, I believe that God is immanent in the affairs of men. I believe in a transcendental and an immanent God. I believe in the power of prayer. I believe that religion is a panacea. I believe that you can heal diseased minds with religion.
Is religion what pulled you through all of those?
Well, I think it's part of it. I don't think it's all of it. I came up in a house, in a home, where prayer was a daily matter and people prayed out loud. I came up in a house where there was no such thing as drinking, smoking, gambling, cursing, but there was lots of love. I knew my mother loved me. I knew my father loved me. I knew my grandmother loved me, and we loved each other. Love was there. Mm-hmm. And I saw my mother and my grandmother sit up half a night, all night long, before Easter and before Christmas, making dresses out of muslin cloth, out of flour sacks, out of anything, and embroidering them and making them pretty for us to wear.
They sacrificed.
They sacrificed. We had a sense of worth. My mother kept saying we were poor, but I never felt a day that I was poor. I was rich. I heard music.
I read books.
I directed little plays. I got the community together when I was 9 years old for my birthday and had an operetta. Don't tell me I'm poor. I was culturally rich. But right was not.
I see that so clearly. And I don't want you to take this the wrong way, but I want to say to you, you really weren't a radical. I don't want to say you were bourgeois. I'm not going to go that far, but I'm going to say you weren't a radical because of all these things that you're saying. You were very much in the heart and soul of the American dream.
Well, I tell you, I don't call it that. I know what the American dream is, and I represent the fulfillment of the American dream. I represent it with the way I live, with my family life, with education. I have raised 4 children and sent them all to college, kept them with homes and cars. That's a bourgeois dream.
Yeah.
You see, that's American dream. But I think from the very beginning, as early as 8 and 9 and 10 years old, I had a sense of worth as a black person who was being mistreated.
Mm-hmm.
I never figured that what those white people were saying about me was true. I knew it wasn't.
I knew better.
Wright knew better. He had a sense of his humanity from the beginning, and nothing could crush that.
Right. That wasn't what was wrong with him.
What was wrong with him?
Richard Wright, wasn't because he believed that crap that they were saying.
Mm-mm.
No.
But it was because he didn't have deep faith and belief in anybody or anything. He didn't believe in God.
Yeah.
He didn't believe in his family. He didn't believe in himself. He hated himself.
Yeah.
He hated himself for being black. He hated himself for being sexually insecure.
Mm-hmm.
He hated himself.
He was a hell of a writer, though, wasn't he?
Great writer. What did all this do but make him a great writer?
Right. Isn't that a tragic thing?
It is.
Why is that? Why is it that adversity does that to us sometimes?
I tell you what, when I was up at Yaddo, I used to look at Carson McCullough's working. And Carson, if there ever was a tortured soul,
mm-hmm.
Miss Carson McCullough's. I said, her husband committed suicide. But it was Carson that you always felt was being driven to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
She lived and went, she had cancer and died after all of that.
Yeah.
She had tuberculosis. She had strokes.
Mm-hmm.
But she was indomitable.
Yeah.
Carson used to sit and write. She said she'd show me a page, and she said, I've been working on this all of the week. 7 days in one page, and I could sit down and write 10 typewritten pages any one day. But mine would not be half as good as that one page.
Mm-hmm. Did you like her?
Liked her very much, and I think she liked me. But what I realized about Carson, I said to somebody, boy, she can't go to sleep at night without Applejack and pills. She can't get up in the morning and get started without Benzedrine.
Mm-hmm.
She's a hell of a writer, but I don't want to be a writer at that expense.
Yeah. How'd you feel about white people during all this time?
Well, I don't think I ever actually hated white people. Once upon a time, I used to feel sorry for them, and then there was a time when I really didn't care about what happened to them.
Yeah, one way or the other.
That's right. But I think when people ask me, the Southern salesman for Jubilee, said, you know, I had to come and see you. I wanted to see if you were like Byron. He said, you know, I sold Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind because I was working at Macmillan's when that book came out. And he said, I have sold this book just like I sold that book. He said, but there's a big difference. He said, if you were a white woman, this book would have already been around the world.
Yeah, it's a better book than Gone with the Wind.
He said, I didn't realize what you were up against till I went in to see my friends at Rich's. Uh-huh. He said, I've always promoted books at Rich's. I went in there and told him we had this new book. It was a prize book. And he wanted to have a publication party at Rich's. He came for the publication party in Jackson. And he was there the next day, I think, when McRae's had a line of people out in the streets signing for Jubilee. He said, you know, I wanted to see if you were as much like Byron as Margaret Mitchell was like Scarlett O'Hara. I said, was she? He said, she was Scarlett O'Hara.
Were you Byron?
I laughed. I said, well, I'll tell you what. I told my mother, and she said, oh, Margaret, you have my grandmother down just like she was. I said, well, you know, Mama, I never saw her. I said, she was dead a month before I was born. Mama said, yes, I sometimes think when I read this, she must have come back and got in you.
What a compliment.
She said, because you sound just like my grandmother.
What
sounded.
A compliment.
I said, Mama, you know who I'm writing about? She said, no, I said, I'm writing about Grandma. Because I see Grandma. She's the one who told me the story. She's the one I've seen. I've watched her.
You're talking about your other grandmother.
No, my own grandmother.
Oh, your grandmother.
Her mother was Byron.
Uh-huh.
Byron was my great-grandmother.
I see.
So I said, I'm talking about your mother, my mother's mother. She said, well, Mama was like her mother. And I said, and are you like Grandma? She said, well, are you like me? And that's really what it is. Women physically, women go through cycles physically, and they do exactly the same as their mothers did.
Mm-hmm.
When they have children, when they give birth, they go through labor and have babies the same way their mothers did.
Yeah. Listen, I'm going to run out of tape here in a minute, and I can't stand to run out of tape until I ask you a couple more things.
Okay,
let me ask you a couple of things real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Was Richard Wright a communist?
Yes.
Was he?
Yes.
Deep in his heart?
What?
I mean, I know he went up to New York and worked for the paper and all that, but was he really?
When you asked me, was Wright a communist, all the 3 years I knew him, he was talking about the Communist Party, and he hated them.
Yeah,
but
that's why I'm asking.
This is what he said. The Communist Party was the only road I had out of that black ghetto in Chicago.
So it wasn't a sense of he feeling deep in his heart.
What did I say in the book? I said he said it was a vehicle.
All right. I just needed you to say that.
It was a vehicle. He worked for them. He said they used me and I used them.
Yeah.
He hated those communists.
Why do you think it is that the Communist Party never really got anywhere with black people in this country, and particularly in the South?
Well, largely because of religion. Largely because of spiritual and moral values. Because they tried to throw out all the ethics, all the morals, all the spiritual ideas that the religionists had put into black people.
Okay.
That's basically all of it. Now, I would say that if you read Marx, and I've read a lot of Marx. If you read Marx and Lenin, and you study the books that the communists want to see you read, you will see a certain class struggle does go on in America. It's always gone. Rich versus the poor.
Right.
Class struggle exists. You will also see that Marx had a certain understanding of society in an historical and economic sense. But as you learn from Plato on, there's no such thing as a perfect government, no ideal government, no
yeah.
perfect government.
Yeah.
And the communists didn't have one anymore. And the communists in America were just as racist and just as prejudiced and just as evil and corrupt as anybody else.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
And they, what they promulgated didn't lead to anything like happiness
mm-hmm.
or success. It just meant more trouble.
All right. Did you ever have a feeling in that period after the war, say in the late 40s, that somehow we were going to get this thing turned around and
it looked like it in the 60s.
I know it did in the 60s, but back there earlier. Did you ever think after the war we might get somewhere until that whole Red Scare came along and kind of...
You must remember that in that period I was working on Jubilee.
Yeah.
And every time I saw something in the paper, I had already read that in the history books about the Civil War
yeah.
and the Reconstruction.
Yeah.
That I lived that thing through twice.
Yeah. It wasn't going to happen voluntarily, was it?
Wasn't going to happen even without being voluntarily, arbitrarily. What we have to understand in this country, I have preached it in all, you have to read my essays to get that.
Yeah.
This country has made a fetish out of race. And until the country learns that humanity is bigger than race, and that every living soul is a human being. Until we learn that, and then I say in my story, in my essays, when we know that, we'll have the millennium.
Yeah. We're a hell of a long way from that right now, aren't we?
We look like we're marching toward Armageddon.
I know.
I said when Saddam Hussein started, I said, oh my God, the world is turning upside down, as the old folks say, and the people in the Pentecostals things say, we must be in the last days.
Yeah, I'm feeling some of that.
We must be in the last days because such horrible
mm-hmm.
things, the wars, the violence, the crime, the drugs, oh my God, could
yeah.
any time be any worse? This is the best of all
yeah.
times. This is the worst.
Yeah. How long ahead of time do you think you saw Brown coming along, the Brown decision?
I sat up in my cousin's living room at the television with my feet propped up because I had water on my tissues and my kidneys were acting up and I was about to have a baby. And I listened to, on May 17th, 1954, 1 month before my baby was born. And I listened to that thing, and I thought the millennium had come.
Were you astonished by that?
Yes.
You were?
I was excited.
It hit you as a big surprise?
Oh, it hit me, and Lord God, I don't believe this is happening. This is the most wonderful thing that I have lived to see the segregation laws tumbling down.
Segregation was at the root of the whole evil, wasn't it?
Well, you know, we Southerners don't want to say that slaves were the reason for the Civil War or the war between the states. They said, oh, no, that's almighty dollar in the northern industry. Slaves were the reason.
Hell, yes, they were. And not only that, but segregation was an invention that came along.
Substitute for the slavery.
Exactly.
Substitute system for slavery.
Yeah.
And now, when we realize that our efforts at integration have not worked, they haven't worked with school integration, They haven't worked in politics. They haven't worked even in our religious institutions.
No.
That, I don't know, Wright was saying it very well when he said, few people in the white world have had all kinds of revolutions, we're going to have some more. And white men, listen, he tells you just what has happened. And he is not optimistic about the future.
Yeah.
He's pessimistic. Because what we have to talk about is the nature of man. But there's a book called Immoral Man
in
an
Immoral
Society. You know that book?
Niebuhr.
I think Niebuhr.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a powerful book.
Yeah.
And what is it saying? The nature of man is not perfect. Isn't that what he said?
Yeah.
And the society can't be any more perfect than the man is.
Yeah, I hear you.
And what we say in our churches, how are we going to have a perfect society when we have such imperfect people?
Yeah. Did you know any white people in the South back in those years, in the 30s and 40s and 50s? Wait a minute.
My family, yes.
Did you know any white people in that time that you felt deep in your heart knew and understood that segregation was the root of the evil and had to be discarded and done away with?
I don't know if they said it, it really was evil, but let me give you two little examples. I told you my sister Mercy Dees went to music college because two white musicians in New Orleans helped her. I haven't told the story. There's a white man who worked at Fisk, and I think he might have worked at Talladega and worked at Dillard, and now he's at Tulane. He's retiring this year from the director of the Amistad Collection.
Cliff Johnson.
Yeah. Clifford Johnson came to see me one day in the last decade and said, we want your papers in the Amistad Collection. He looked around my two rooms of books and tables and top files. He said, you bring a truck up here. We'll empty up these files and cabinets and boxes.